This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while vetted by residents, is not personally verified by our hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided in this podcast and in any linked materials is not intended and should not be construed as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We try to stay away from opinions, but all opinions represented are our own and not of the University of Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome
to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to another edition of the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast. Over here on the Vanderbilt side with JP. And so, JP, I feel like when I have a patient with anemia and thrombocytopenia, I know what labs to send, but I don't really necessarily know what they mean. But I heard Casey gave us a good presentation on thrombotic microangiopathies. Can you fill me in on that?
Sure. She did give us a really clear presentation on an incredibly complex topic. The big difference that we want to make is between that microangiopathic hemolytic anemia by itself, which is basically non-immune hemolysis. So that's going to happen in the microvasculature. It happens with prosthetic heart valves, trigger assist devices. So you have hemolysis, but you don't have the thrombosis component. The TMA spectrum, or thrombotic microangiopathy, is the microangiopathic hemolytic anemia plus thrombocytopenia. And this is going to be related to some specific pathologic lesion in the arterioles and the capillaries that leads to microvascular thrombosis, right? So that's the pathognomonic TMA is when you biopsy a tissue and there's these microvascular thrombosis in the setting of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia plus thrombocytopenia. Now, before we used to sort of classify them simply into hemolytic uremic syndrome and TTP, now it's a lot more complex. There's basically four or five classifications, including primary TMAs, which tend to be hereditary, acquired primary TMAs, secondary TMAs, infection-associated TMAs, and unexplained TMAs. So as you can see, there's a lot of that we are now finding out about thrombotic microangiopathy. So when you have a suspected TMA, you have to confirm hemolysis, you confirm the thrombocytopenia, and then you look for an underlying condition, because we see adults and more than children. So an underlying condition is more common in adults. So what are these underlying conditions that will give you a TMA? Big ones, right? So DIC, infection, malignancy, and the preeclampsia HELLP syndrome spectrum, severe hypertension or severe rheumatic disease, and solid organ transplant patients can actually have it. It can be a toxicity related weak. But these are kind of the big buckets, right? So, and how do you treat this? You treat the underlying condition. When you have an underlying condition giving you a TMA, you treat the underlying condition. Now, if the patients don't have an underlying condition and they're adults, we're going to focus on the differential being, is there any kidney injury, is there not any kidney injury? Because that's going to drive some of our management. In children, this difference of not having any underlying condition hinges on bloody diarrhea, yes or no, and then you go down the Shiga-toxin spectrum of illness. But in adults, you basically focus on the kidney injury. And if they don't have any kidney injury, then you kind of classify it in the TTP bucket. If they do have kidney injury, then you try to differentiate it between acute and chronic. The acute ones being sort of drug-induced. Here, we would put the Shiga toxin HUS within adults. Again, the diarrhea might not be present, so that's a big difference. And then complement-mediated TMAs, metabolism, coagulation-mediated TMA, and then TTP is less likely, but it's still on there. Again, big things that we're looking at here is that you need to have hemolysis, thrombocytopenia, evidence of some sort of infarction, and then you start seeing which organs are affected. And that's when you start evaluating the kidney and you treat the underlying condition. So there's been a lot of discussion in the literature and a lot of data on the complement system and how it activates TMA. Suffice it to say that eculizumab, which is a C5a inhibitor, has come to the forefront as a potential treatment for complement-induced thrombotic microangiopathy. We still don't have the best data out there on specifically how we're supposed to treat this in terms of length, duration, relationship to PLEX. And again, all of this is data that's being actively studied. But suffice it to say that complement activation will lead to microthrombi and can actually set off the TMA cascade. So eculizumab, or C5a inhibitor, is one of those future directions in terms of therapy for TMAs.
So JP, one of the most difficult things that we have to deal with in the hospitals when a immune compromised patient comes in with a variety of complaints. However, one of the scariest ones is when they come in short of breath, you find out that they're hypoxic. I heard Pierce gave us a great presentation on PJP. What did he say about that?
Peers actually address PJP from an interesting perspective, because we see PJP mostly in the setting of HIV/AIDS, right? It's one of the AIDS-defining illnesses. He approached it from the immunocompromised individual that doesn't have HIV, doesn't have AIDS. And we'll get to that a little bit more. We'll focus on big take-home messages from PJP as a whole, and then we'll differentiate a little between those two, HIV versus non-HIV. Nowadays, we know that pneumocystis, I'm going to butcher this, but Giroveshi, PJP is a fungus based on ribosomal RNA, and PCP is the appropriate term for pneumocystis pneumonia. Okay, the biggest risk factor for pneumocystis is being infected with HIV and not taking ART. You can also be immunosuppressed, particularly in people that are taking steroids. And this is one of the big take-homes from Pierce's talk. Steroids. If taking steroids, prednisone, you know, more than 20 to 40 milligrams for more than 4 to 6 weeks, you need to put your patients on PJP prophylaxis, period. What other risk factors together with HIV? So a CD4 count less than 200 cells, big one. And how do these patients present? So it's a difference between the HIV-infected patients and the non-HIV-infected patients. Non-HIV-infected patients will present acutely, kind of like a bacterial pneumonia. They'll just fall off the cliff. With HIV-infected patients, they start with sort of the typical fever, dry cough, and dyspnea that can last from days to weeks. And it can take about 3 weeks for them to present. And then they'll have the fever, tachypnea. Crackles and ronchi are the commonly described findings on exam, but even up to 50% of patients can have a normal exam. The issue with PJP is you have to have a high index of suspicion for this particular disease, because the only way to actually diagnose it is to find the fungus in the tissue, which is hard because we're not going to get tissue on everyone. So when do you start suspecting it based on lab data? Again, as we said, CD4 count less than 200, a high AA difference, right? So this hypoxemia, which you were referring to in the beginning, that's something that we need to look at, and that actually helps us stratify disease. So a high AA difference is something that we need to consider. LDH elevation, which is a poor prognostic sign, irrelevant of HIV status. 1,3-beta-D-glucan can be elevated because it is a component of the PJP cell wall. And the chest x-ray can have diffuse bilateral, interstitial, alveolar infiltrates, but it can be normal, again, in up to a quarter of patients. So high level of suspicion for this disease. And as we said, how do you diagnose it? You see the organism. It's pretty much it. So what's the differential? It can be big, particularly with immunosuppressed patients, right? Because you're talking about TB, non-tuberculous mycobacteria, fungi, toxo, CMV, influenza, kappa C. So a lot of things, which is why high index of suspicion. So what's the treatment? If it's an HIV patient, you start them on ART, and then you can start them on treatment for PJP. Treatment for PJP in the HIV patients is stratified into three: mild, moderate, and severe. And this is based on the AA difference. Mild disease is an AA difference of less than 35 millimeters of mercury or a PaO2 of greater than 70. You can just treat them with oral Bactrim as an outpatient. For moderate, which is an AA difference that's greater than 35 but less than 45, and a PaO2 that's less than 70 but greater than 60, you start oral Bactrim and oral steroids, but this is as an inpatient. And a severe, which is also as inpatient, you start IV Bactrim and IV steroids.
So JP, another complication of immune-compromised patients that can happen is CMV. And I heard Chelsea gave us a great presentation on CMV and a specific complication of that, CMV retinitis. Can you fill me in on that?
She did. Chelsea gave us a great presentation on CMV retinitis, which essentially is reactivation of latent disease in patients with advanced immunosuppression. It is one of the most serious ocular complications of patients that have AIDS. So this is something that would need to be on the lookout for. And she basically said, right, so CMV has a seroprevalence. So basically around 40 to 100% of people have been exposed to CMV. So there's going to be CMV titers. It's an issue that you can divide this, the types of infection for CMV, between primary infection, latent infection, and reactivation. And this all hinges on T cell response. And that's where Chelsea focused her presentation, which was fantastic. The T cell response is what's going to mediate how your body responds to CMV. So as soon as your T cell response becomes impaired, that's when you're at risk for CMV reactivation. One of these is CMV retinitis. She said that it's often unilateral presentation, and the symptoms can be fairly nonspecific, so floaters, scotoma, flashing lights. But the problem is that it can cause full thickness necrosis that is non-reversible. So basically, the portions of the retina that are going to be destroyed by CMV do not regenerate. So the goal of therapy for CMV retinitis is going to be to prevent further retinal necrosis. what are other complications that can be associated with CMV? You know, colitis, esophagitis, pneumonitis, encephalitis, dementia. So basically, this CMV is just colonizing the tissue, but she focused on ocular manifestations of CMV. So what's the standard of therapy? You give ganciclovir as first line, and you can also use valganciclovir, foscarnet, cidofovir, and this depends on resistance of the CMV and how the patient is responding. There are two types of lesions, right? The site-threatening lesions and the no site-threatening lesions, depending on where the CMV is affecting the retina. So this is something that needs to be evaluated both by ophthalmology and by infectious disease fairly quickly when these patients present. So as we were saying, CMV retinitis, most serious complication of patients with AIDS. It can cause multiple changes in the eye, right? So uveitis, endothelitis, and vision loss is non-reversible. This is all going to be mediated by a lack of a T-cell response. In first line of therapy is going to be ganciclovir. And if you might need intravitreal injections for site-threatening lesions versus systemic therapy. And there's actually new antiviral prophylaxis that's being used for stem cell transplant patients.
All right, guys, thanks for listening and learning with me. I think this is going to be the last podcast that I do. I'm graduating residency and handing it off to two very capable residents. So I'm excited to see what direction that they take it in the future. But until next time.